I'm actually, I would like to begin by saying that I am really very, very impressed with this whole program. I never saw a program quite like this. I've seen conventions of rabbis and other conferences, but something that started last night and is going on for more than half the day today. Very extraordinary. Literally, Torah is in motion in Toronto. And I want to thank publicly my hosts, Rabbi Jay and Ilana Kelman, for being magnificent hosts. I left a note in the guest book. By the order of El Natan. He wouldn't let me out of the house until I had signed the guest book and written some kind of a note. Quite extraordinary. But also to compliment them on, and Dr. Malamed, on this fantastic program, to which I'm very happy to make my own Nofech Mishalo, my own add-on. So, with apologies for not having printed out the Gemara for you, I'm going to go through this piece of Gemara. If you want to look it up, it's in Bava Metzia, page 59b, Nuntes Amud Beis. Very famous dispute between Rabbi Eliezer and the sages. No, really, Jay, what is the ending time here?
I would say one of the questions for the end. I would end by 1:35 or so.
Okay. Okay, good. So the Talmud begins as follows. We have learned in a Mishnah that if someone cut sections for an oven and put sand between the sections in order to cement them together, and the oven then came in contact with tum'ah, ritual defilement, Rabbi Eliezer declares it to be tahor, while the sages declare it to be tameh. So there is a basic rule that an item cannot be susceptible to ritual impurity, tum'ah, if it's not a vessel. It has to be something that holds something in it, has a base kibbutz, it's called in Talmudic language. It has to hold contents. Only a vessel can become tameh. Rabbi Eliezer is saying that this oven is simply a collection of pieces, and therefore it does not constitute a vessel. It's just pieces cemented together. While the sages are saying that since it looks like a vessel and it functions like a vessel, it's a vessel, and therefore it's susceptible to tumah. Somebody once said something similar about kugel. Why is kugel called kugel? Anybody know? Well, because it looks like kugel, it smells like kugel, and it tastes like kugel, so it's kugel. This controversy is known as the oven of the coiled serpent, Tanur Shel Achnoi. The coiled serpent refers to how the sages surrounded the oven with discussions, like a coiled snake. The Talmud then continues to relate how the controversy became more acute. Rabbi Eliezer advanced all the arguments in the world to defend his lenient ruling, but the sages would not accept them. He said to them, if the halacha accords with me, let this carob tree prove it. Whereupon the carob tree was uprooted from its place and moved 100 amos, about the length of a football field. The sages said to him, we do not accept proof from carob trees. So he said to them, if the halacha accords with me, let this water canal prove it. Whereupon the water in the canal flowed backwards. The sages said to him, we don't accept proof from water canals. Rabbi Eliezer then said to them, if the halakha accords with me, let the walls of this study hall prove it. Whereupon the walls of the study hall leaned and were about to fall. Immediately Rabbi Yehoshua rebuked the walls and said to them, if Torah scholars are having an argument, one with the other, what business is it of yours? So the walls, therefore, did not fall out of respect for Rabbi Yehoshua, but neither did they right themselves out of respect for Rabbi Eliezer. And they still continue to lean to this day. Rabbi Eliezer then said to the sages, this was the trump card. If the halakha accords with me, let heaven prove it. Whereupon a bas kol, a heavenly voice, proclaimed, what argument do you have with Rabbi Eliezer, whom the halakha follows in all places, even when he's against the rabbim? Upon hearing this, Rabbi Yehoshua stood on his feet and declared, lo bashamayim he, the Torah is not in heaven. The Gemara then explains that the concept, it's not in heaven, means that we don't pay heed to bas kols, to heavenly voices, in matters of halacha. For the Torah was already given to mankind at Mount Sinai. In other words, God wrote in the Torah that all decisions should be rendered according to majority rule, acharei rabim lahatot. And since the majority of the sages dispute Rabbi Eliezer's position, the ruling goes against him, regardless of any heavenly intervention. The Gemara concludes as follows. Rabbi Nosson met Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet, and asked him, what was God doing at that moment when Rabbi Yehoshua rejected the heavenly signal and repudiated the ruling of Rabbi Eliezer? Eliyahu HaNavi responded, he, the Holy One, was smiling and said, Nitzchuni Banai, my children have prevailed over me. Nitzchuni Banai, my children have prevailed over me. What is the meaning of this response of God, Nitzchuni Banai, as reported by Elijah? It appears to be that God has nachas, as it were, that his children have prevailed over him in interpreting the Torah, and that they actually can override God's opinion, as it were. It would seem to be that God is saying that once he gave the Torah to us, it's no longer in his hands. It belongs to the Jewish people. The halachic scholars in every generation have to decide what the Torah means, to interpret its words, even if it means overriding God's opinion or original intention, kaviyachol, as it were. What the scholars say the Torah means is what the Torah means. That's the way this is usually interpreted. However, Rav Yehuda Amital, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, the founder of Yeshivat Har Etzion in Alon Shvut, who passed away about 6 years ago, interpreted this statement very differently. What, he asked, were Rabbi Eliezer and the Chachamim really arguing about? What is the essence of the dispute about whether an oven put together with pieces is an oven or not, and therefore susceptible to tumah or not? Rabbi Eliezer says that there is an objective truth operating here. Objectively, this oven is a potpourri of shards. It's a bunch of pieces glued together. Hence, it is not a vessel, which means it lacks the ability to become tamei. The Chachamim agree that Rabbi Eliezer is right from an objective point of view, Rav Amital says. Subjectively, however, from a human perspective, he's all wrong. This collection of pieces looks like an oven, functions like an oven, and therefore is an oven. As such, it is classified as a vessel, and it can become tamei. Where is God in all of this? Rav Amital claims that God essentially agrees with Rabbi Eliezer because God functions on a level of objective truth. However, when God smiles and says, "Nitzchuni banai, my children have prevailed over me," he's saying in the real world, he's acknowledging that it's more than simply a majority overruling his opinion. God is saying that humanity cannot live life on a level of absolute objective truth. Human beings function on a subjective level, and we can only try our best. And God happily accepts that effort. Ultimately, God agrees that in the real world, the halacha should be decided that way, taking into consideration human needs, human strivings, and human failings. That's what Nitzchuni Banai means, according to Rav Amital. I actually had many discussions about halacha with Rav Amital on his visits to New York. I found that he invariably ruled with the human condition in mind. Let me present one example of his subjective approach. A secular Jewish family came to Israel from the former Soviet Union and settled in Efrat. One of the two sons in the family was about to be married, but his brother, an avowed atheist and a Fabrenta communist, told him that if, God forbid, the marrying brother should die childless, he, the unmarried brother, will refuse to participate in the chalitza ceremony, which would be necessary in order to release the widow to marry again. To him, that ceremony was repulsive and barbaric, and he was adamantly opposed to participating in it, and he warned his brother in advance. By way of further clarification, the ceremony of chalitza is extremely rare all over the Jewish world. In 58 years in the rabbinate, I have never encountered it, although right now I have my first case of a widow who needs chalitza. But otherwise, I never encountered it. In Israel, however, where young men serve in the army and therefore their lives are in danger, it is unfortunately not so rare for a man to be killed in action while his wife is still childless. The wife needs chalitza to be performed by a surviving brother, if one exists, in order for her to be able to marry again. Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, who was to be the officiant at the marriage ceremony, did not want to take the responsibility upon his shoulders and ignore possible, God forbid, dreadful consequences. So he took the matter to Rav Amital. Rav Amital ruled that the young man should marry his bride conditionally, al tanai. When putting the ring on his bride's finger, he should say, "Hare at mekudeshet li betaba'at zo, you're wedded unto me with this ring, kedat Moshe v'Yisrael, according to the law of Moses in Israel, on condition that if I die before you have given birth to a child, the marriage is nullified ab initio. In effect, the marriage would be annulled from the moment it began, if the condition were met. Now, the subject of conditional marriages is discussed in the Talmud, but in general, the halachic authorities of every generation have rejected such marriages. They didn't want to see marriages annulled by a condition being fulfilled, and therefore the marriage is annulled. Rav Amital ruled against this halachic tradition because of the human situation involved in this marriage and his sensitivity to the needs of the couple. Rav Amital was not alone in rendering halachic decisions based on subjective considerations. I will present three poignant examples of other rabbis ruling subjectively when approached about religious rulings, keeping in mind the human condition and the context from which the questions arose. First example, a boy from a secular family of Soviet Jews was being prepared for his bar mitzvah in Jerusalem. He was going to read the Haftarah. 2 days before the Shabbos of his bar mitzvah, it was discovered that his teacher had made a mistake and taught him the Haftarah, which had been read the previous week. As a bar mitzvah teacher many, many years ago, I used to have nightmares about that possibility. The problem was brought to the attention of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who ruled that the boy should read the Haftarah for which he was prepared 1 week late. Presumably, Rav Shlomo Zalman took into consideration the fact that the correct Haftorah on any given Shabbos is a rabbinic command, it's a derabbanan, whereas the Torah principle of kavod habriot, consideration for the feelings of a human being, is a d'oraisa and overrode the rabbinic requirement. On the following day, the Shabbos of the bar mitzvah, Rav Shlomo Zalman walked a great distance and showed up in the bar mitzvah boy's shul. He was there presumably to make sure that nobody raised an objection about the reading of the wrong Haftorah. If Rav Shlomo Zalman was there and listening, nobody could say a word. Second example. An even more poignant situation was brought to Rav Shlomo Zalman, which demonstrated his sensitivity toward the human condition in deciding Jewish law. Rav Shlomo Zalman was known to be extremely strict on the subject of abortion. He was machmir. He would almost never allow an abortion to be held. With the possible exception of rape, he would not rule leniently. A woman came to him in great distress. She had just learned that she was carrying a Tay-Sachs fetus. She told Rav Auerbach that she had six children and that she and her family could not possibly handle having a Tay-Sachs baby. Rav Auerbach said to her, "Don't ask me this, Shaila. Go down the block to Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer, who was known to be a makil in matters like this, and ask him the question." Rav Shlomo Zalman knew what Rav Waldenberg would say to her, and he didn't want to even hear the Shaila. He said, "Go to Rav Eliezer Waldenberg and ask him the question." Third example. My maternal grandfather, Isidor Schlang, of blessed memory, had prostate surgery in his mid-70s. At that time, one stayed in the hospital for 10 days to 2 weeks with a catheter and a bag. My grandfather was quite upset that he couldn't put on tefillin because he knew that the donning of tefillin requires a guf naki, a clean body, which he didn't have with the catheter in him. He asked me to ask Rav Soloveitchik whether he could put on tefillin. I said, "You want me to call the Rav to ask him this question?" He says, "Yes, call your Rebbe." So I called the Rav and told him the problem. The Rav's answer was immediate and revealing. He said, "It's true that tefillin requires a guf naki. However," he said, "I met your grandfather once. He is a sincerely religious man. Tell him to cover everything with a sheet and put on tefillin, and may he have a refuah shleima." This was a psak in the subjective world in which human beings live. And a smiling God will surely say, "Nitzchuni banai, my children have prevailed over me," because they don't live in an objective world. They live in a subjective world. There are many apocryphal stories about rabbis of a prior generation who ruled leniently because of special human considerations. One such example is not apocryphal. It took place with my father of blessed memory, Rabbi Joseph H. Lookstein. My father told me he witnessed such a moment in the home of my great-grandfather, the Ramaz, Rav Moshe Zvulun Margolis, whose granddaughter was my mother. It was a Friday afternoon, and a poor woman came to the Ramaz with a chicken to ask him a shaila about its kashrus. My great-grandfather showed my father the chicken and then invited him to come with him into my great-grandfather's study. The Ramaz asked my father, "Nu, mein kind, vazakstu, what do you say?" My father replied, "It was an open and shut case. There was a hole in the stomach of the chicken, which was clearly made by a needle that the chicken had swallowed, and this rendered the chicken treif. It's a clear treifa." "Not so fast," my great-grandfather told his young assistant. And he went over to the bookcase and took out a sefer and showed my father that in a similar case, a particular achron was lenient. He then proceeded to take out another sefer from the bookcase and showed my father how another achron also ruled leniently in such a case. He then said to my father, "Mein kind, this is a poor woman. If we declare the chicken to be treif, she will have nothing to eat on Shabbos. You take a little bit of responsibility on your shoulders, and I'll take a little bit on my shoulders, and we will rely on these two achronim and let this woman have a good Shabbos. Nitzchuni banai." Unfortunately, this approach, so consistently demonstrated by Rav Amital, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and reflected also in some of the decisions of Rav Shlomo Zalman, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and the Rav, and my great-grandfather, is often missing in our day in the halachic decisions pronounced by many authorities in Israel and in America. I saw it firsthand in Jerusalem this past summer. Some of you are familiar with this, but let me tell you essentially the case. A young woman whom I and my assistant rabbi, Rabbi Weinstock, and our younger assistant rabbi, Rabbi Feldman, we had converted this woman in the West Side Mikveh in New York City after having studied with her for the better part of a year. This woman made Aliyah to Israel unbeknownst to me. And there she fell in love with a young Sephardi man from Petah Tikva. And they went to the to the rabbinate in Petah Tikva to open up a file for a marriage. And the rabbi asked where she comes from, and she told him, and she told him that she was a Gioress and that I had supervised the conversion. The rabbi said, Harav Hazeh Eino Mukar Lanu. We don't know who this rabbi is. So I called Rabbi Seth Farber in Israel. Rabbi Farber is a person who helps people navigate the labyrinth of the chief rabbinate and the whole rabbinate in Israel on questions of Jewish identity and marriage and gerus and so on. And he put in an appeal to the chief rabbinate in Israel. And the chief rabbinate sent a letter to Petah Tikva saying, we recognize the conversions of Rabbi Luchstein in New York. And the Petah Tikva Beis Din said, Harav Hazeh Eino Mukar Lanu. This rabbi is not known to us. So Rabbi Farber went to the chief rabbis, and each one of the chief rabbis, who's the Ashkenazic chief rabbi? Rav Lau, Rav David Lau, and Rav Yosef, the Sephardi chief rabbi, each issued a letter to the court in Jerusalem, the Supreme Rabbinic Court in Jerusalem, saying that the conversion done by Rabbi Luchstein is an acceptable conversion and can be relied upon. And they set up an appeals court in the Supreme Chief Rabbinical Court in Yerushalayim. And the Supreme Court said, we will not rule on the matter of the conversion of Rabbi Luchstein. And we don't want to take the time to do that because it's going to take us a few weeks to do that, mind you. It's not difficult to get in touch with me in New York by phone, by email, by text. It's relatively simple. I never received a call from anybody except Rabbi Seth Farber. Nobody ever contacted me to find out who this woman is, what was the nature of the conversion, nothing. They simply would not rule on the matter of the conversion. They said it would take too much time. If you want to save time, we will ask you to make a declaration in court, saying you believe in God, you are accepting Torah and mitzvos, you understand the principles of reward and punishment, you are ready to become a Jew and accept all the anti-Semites in the world, all the questions that we ask a convert at the mikveh before immersion. They said, if you declare that here for the, and you say, I'm making the declaration for the purpose of Geirut, conversion, we will accept you as a convert and you can go and get married. So she said, this is very humiliating to me. I'm already Jewish. She didn't actually say it. She said it through her lawyer that was provided by Rabbi Farber. It's humiliating to me. It's humiliating to my rabbi. It was not humiliating to me. I did not feel in any way humiliated. I just felt outraged at the sinful behavior of rabbis in Israel. How they justified this to themselves and didn't klap al chet on Yom Kippur for inui hager, torturing a convert, because she was a good convert. I know she was a good convert. They don't know she wasn't. They're just engaged in some kind of political power struggle. So I was not humiliated by it, not at all. On the contrary, I was buoyed by the whole thing because we went public with it and it became a big, big deal all over Israel. And there was a protest outside the court right before they held their proceedings in which many Ramaz alumni participated. And Natan Sharansky came and he protested for me, which was ironic because I had spent so many years protesting for Natan Sharansky. And, you know, we both kibitzed about it. The next day, he happened to be in New York, and we met in my office. We're very, very close friends. And what's her name? Ilana Shaked? Ayelet Shaked, Minister of Justice. She came, and she protested. It was fine for me. What was terrible was that this woman, who was going through what should be the happiest moments in her life, was in agony over would she be able to get married or not. How could they do that to another human being? Just ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. Forget about the 36 specific mentions in the Torah that the Talmud says exist about how to treat a ger. So, afterwards, just take a second. Let me finish my train of thought. So they made her do this, and she did it. And they said, now you are Jewish, and you can go and get married. So she said, but what about mikvah? Now listen to this. If you know anything about Geirus, you know that mikvah in the presence of three religious men, today rabbis, but it's actually three religious men, have to supervise the going into the mikvah. Exactly how it's done is depends upon the rabbinic court. In our case, we do it very, very modestly. She said, you're going to have to go to mikveh anyway before your marriage and get a mikveh certificate. In Israel, you need a mikveh certificate. If you want to know, there's a market for mikveh certificates in Israel. You're going to have to go to mikveh for your marriage. That will constitute the mikveh for conversion. So she's not stupid, or her lawyer isn't stupid. And they asked, but don't you need three rabbis there? And they said, no, no, you don't really need three rabbis. The declaration here is enough. That's not true. That's a subterfuge. They were forcing her to go through this because they didn't have the guts to accept the two letters from the two chief rabbis that my conversion, that's to the extent to which the power struggle was going on. Well, there's a happy ending to it. And the happy ending is that she was married on September 19th. Rabbi Seth Farber officiated at the marriage. And thank God, the case is closed. However, it proved that the present situation on Geirus in Israel is untenable because the official rabbinate is following some kind of theoretical, absolute interpretation of halacha that doesn't work in the real world. They will not recognize the conversions of anybody done outside. It has to be verified. You know, most recently, you may have read it or seen it on the internet, there were a couple of cases of converts for whom Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, the posek for the modern Orthodox community in America and the Bezdin of America, the Rosh Bezdin, He should have a refuah shleima. Unfortunately, he's very, very ill right now. Rav Gedalia Schwartz had vouched for the conversion. Rav Mordechai Willig, Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University, who's the Skan Rosh Bezdin of the Bezdin of America, the RCA Bezdin, had vouched for it. And the rabbinical court in Jerusalem said, we don't accept this validation. A good friend of mine came to me very recently. He said, you know, I saw this happen. He said, I think since you have two letters from the two chief rabbis that your conversions are good, you should write a letter to the rabbinical court in Jerusalem vouching for the validity of Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz and Rav Mordechai Willig and saying that you can assure them that these people are worthy of. If it weren't sad, it would be hilarious. But unfortunately, it's not hilarious. It's very sad. Sad for many reasons. You've heard the personal hurt that goes on here. Well, what about the 300,000 to 400,000 Russians who are former Soviet Union living in Israel? They or their children going to Israeli schools, they're speaking Hebrew, they're part of Israeli life. In another generation, if these people are not converted, which would require very lenient rules for conversion, rules that would make sense in the subjective world. They want to be part of the Jewish people. They're serving in the army. They can get killed, and if they get killed, they can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery. They have to be buried on the side of the cemetery. And we have groups of rabbis, Rabbanei Tzohar and Benny Ish Shalom of, what's the name of the organization? I'm forgetting it right now. I'll think of it in a minute. And Rabbi Farber and Rav Druckman and others who are ready to convert. And there are Batei Din that are converting these people, but it needs to be done on a very large scale. And the rabbinate will not allow it because the rabbinate sees these people as a threat to the purity of the Jewish people instead of seeing them as an opportunity to solve the problem of assimilation, which is going to be hitting us from all sides in the years to come with Israelis intermarrying with Hebrew-speaking Israeli former immigrants from the Soviet Union and their children by the tens of thousands. But we can't get it done because of the system there. Now I want to tell you one further thing, which I don't want to make too much of a fuss about. And that is that the current situation on Geirut in Israel is now functioning in the United States as well, and I believe most probably in Canada, because the official modern Orthodox rabbinic organization, my organization, the Rabbinical Council of America, to whom I turned when I had the problem with the Gioret in Israel last spring, I went to the head of the Beit Din of America, who's a wonderful, wonderful rabbi and scholar, wonderful graduate of Columbia Law School, Yora Yodin Yodin from Yeshiva, Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, and a good friend of mine. I'm a vice president of the Beit Din of America. I said to him, I need an Ishur on my conversion so that it will be accepted by the rabbinic court in Petah Tikva. And he said to me, my hands are tied because the RCA has a policy. Now there's a new system of, it's called the GPS system for Geirus in North America. And the only conversions that we will validate are those done under GPS. We recognize that responsible rabbis will do conversions outside GPS, but we can't give an issuer for them. We accept the fact that they're going to do them, but we cannot give a validation of them. Now, I ask you, what's going to happen to the children of my converts, some of whom I convert through GPS, but many of whom I don't convert through GPS? I'll tell you why in a minute. What's going to happen to their children 25 years from now when they want to get married? Are other rabbis going to accept those children of converts, or will they have to undergo another conversion, l'chumra? The answer will be up to the particular rabbi. And I don't know what's going to happen in 25 years. I see my former colleague, Rabbi Seth Grauer, is here. I've heard you're doing tremendous, tremendous work here. A big, big yasher koach. What's he going to do when somebody comes to him in 25 years? How is he going to rule? Very difficult question. Now, she'll ask me, how come I don't do everything through the GPS system? So I'll tell you. Let me give a couple of examples of how that GPS system works in New York. A woman spends a year studying how to live an observant Jewish life and is shomeret mitzvot before her conversion, already doing everything right. She then sits before a Beit Din of anonymous rabbis, and she's interviewed for 2 hours because that Beit Din is a gatekeeping Beit Din to make sure nobody who's not 110% gets in. It's not a welcoming Beit Din, which is what our Beit Din is. Every ger that we work with knows we're not out to test the ger. We're out to welcome the ger with standards. And we have strong standards, but we're not a threat to them. We're welcoming them. We're not gatekeeping. So she is interrogated, and I'm using the word interrogated advisedly, for 2 hours, and Rabbi Weinstock and I are sitting there to be supportive. Some of the questions are, what kind of dress will you wear to your wedding? Will it have long sleeves or short sleeves? Do you know how to cook for Shabbos? The candidate answers perfectly. The questioner continues, what do you have to be careful about when you make salad on Shabbos? So what do you think is the answer to that question? Not you. Who wants to give me an answer? What do you have to be careful about when you make salad on Shabbos? Okay, they were not talking about the bugs, okay. Because that's not a Shabbos issue. Correct. Maybe, yeah, but yeah, you're close. Oh, all right, that's not what they were thinking either. This convert, I was ready to sock the guy in the nose who asked that question. I mean, how do you ask a question of a convert that way? Of course, I kept my cool and I didn't say anything. And the convert was a class act and also a magnificent student. And she answered without batting an eye, you have to be careful not to separate out the bad stuff from the good stuff. She was talking about exactly Borer. How many people in the shul in which she will daven, and she davens in shul on a regular basis, how many people are careful about Borer when they make salad on Shabbos? It's absurd to be asking questions like that. Another example. We had a Chinese woman preparing more than a year for conversion. She knows her stuff. and she's living as a modern Orthodox Jewish woman. She makes a wonderful impression on the anonymous Beisdin. They're very impressed with her knowledge. But then one of the Dayanim offers her a cookie and watches to see what bracha she would make. She made the bracha, Bore Mine Mizonos. And then he asks her, what bracha do you make after eating the cookie? The candidate was flustered and couldn't answer the question properly. She didn't yet know Al HaMichya. 2 weeks later, the candidate gets an email from the Beit Din, which I got a copy of and Rabbi Weinstock got a copy. And it says, we were very impressed with your knowledge and your desire to become a Jew, but we cannot convert you as yet because you have to develop fluency in brachos achronos. That is crazy. What test would you give the members of any shul in the modern Orthodox world on fluency in brachos achronos? It's clear that the people running the system, both in Israel and in America, are following Rabbi Eliezer, some kind of theoretical absolute halakha, and not the chachamim halakha, which deals with the real situation in which people live. The result is gatekeeping rather than welcoming. I'm happy to tell you there are happy endings to both of these particular stories. In each case, the convert is living a modern Orthodox life with adherence to Torah and mitzvot and going to shul regularly. One of their children is already in the kindergarten in Ramaz. And in the case of the second one, the kids are still a little bit too young, but with God's help, if the grandfather will help with the tuition, they will be in Ramaz as well. In rendering halachic decisions in a challenging world, we need to follow the approach of Rav Amital and other great rabbis who understood that while Rabbi Eliezer's theoretical and absolute approach to halacha may have serious validity, it may even be the choice of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the living halacha has to follow the approach of the Chachamim, taking into consideration the reality of the human condition, the facts that operate in this world, and the need to practice love and sensitivity to human beings who want to live a halachic life. Let me conclude with a story that Rav Amital loved to tell about Rav Schneur Zalman of Ladi, the Baal HaTanya, the founder of Chabad. He was once studying Torah at home when he heard a baby crying in the next room. He stopped studying, went to comfort the baby, and then returned to his studies. While returning, he noticed that his son, who was also learning Torah, had never moved to help his baby. He asked him why he didn't move when the baby cried. The son answered, "I was so immersed in my study of Torah that I didn't hear the baby cry." The Rebbe responded, "If you were so immersed in Torah that you didn't hear the cry of a baby, it's a sign that there is something wrong with your study of Torah." You know, if today's rabbinic establishment in Israel and in America could just render halachic decisions with an awareness of the Rebbe's response, we could change a world. Thank you. Now, you still have a question? Please, or a comment. What? Okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
First of all, Rabbi Luxing, thank you very much. A wonderful lecture. My name is Dr. Zoberman. Many people who live here know me. I was a Moyal on the front lines for almost 45 years. And so I just wanted to address one issue, and that's Gayrus. Gayrus in the year 2016, and prior to that, I started doing Bris Milah in 1971, 72, is a very, very, very problematic area of Jewish life. And I'm not disagreeing with anything that you've said other than to say it's so, so complex and so problematic that there are no simple solutions to the manifold problems that exist with Gayrus. We, meaning Eschatoi Aini Maskar Hayoim, meaning the Orthodox, we the Orthodox Jews, rabbinate, are to some degree responsible for the situation, and no one story or even 10 stories will be able to address the multitude of problems here and in Israel. And if people seem paranoid, Rabbonim or others who are osek in it, there is a reason. I don't have to recount to you, but I can remember very vividly. I came to see a baby of somebody who had been converted by a well-known Orthodox rabbi. At least a mother had been converted, and I don't want to say even which city, but he had written many svarim, and he was a Talmud Chacham Mufik, and the mother was converted. She married this young man who was not religious, but that's neither here or there. And I came to see the baby. It was Pesach, and in front of me, they were eating bread. But that's not a problem. I can do a bris if they eat bread. That's not a problem. But the bris was supposed to be on Shabbos, and in front of me also was sitting the grandmother of the other side, wearing a cross, like a huge cross, and I'm here called in to do the bris on Shabbos. As it worked out, unfortunately, the baby had a problem and we delayed it, but that's neither. Okay. And I did the bris. It's just that it represents that story or that little vignette.
Okay.
Represents.
Can I respond?
One more word I want to say. This isn't anything new. As you know, the Rambam in Hilchas Isurei Bia asks the question, how did Delilah get converted? And how did Bat Paro get converted for Shlomo? And I don't want to go into the
no,
details.
No, we can't go into
no,
it.
But it's been a problem since that time at least.
Okay.
The Shoftim and the time of Shlomo.
Okay.
And the problem exists now.
Okay.
And it's that's all I want to say.
Okay, so I'm going to respond to it with a story about Rav Soloveitchik. Many years ago, I sat down with a couple to interview them before their marriage and do some the first of two or three sessions of premarital counseling. And I've discovered that the woman, the bride, is the daughter of a woman who was converted during World War II. I asked, "Who converted you?" She gave me the name of the rabbi. I said, "Can I, you know, still contact him?" She said, "No, he died." I said, "What was the shul?" She gave me the name of the shul, but the shul no longer existed. So there were no records that I could rely on. But I knew the name of the rabbi. So I called Rabbi Israel Klavan, Olav HaShalom, who was the executive vice president of the Rabbinical Council of America, which is what I always did in a situation like that. And I said, "Here's the name of the rabbi. Can I rely on his gerus?" Rabbi Klavan said, "I really didn't know him. I've heard his name, but I didn't know him," which is very unusual because Rabbi Klavan knew everybody. "I didn't know him. Why don't you ask the Rav?" I said, "The Rav? I should ask the Rav? How would he know him?" He said, "I have a feeling the Rav might know him." So I called up the Rav, and I told him the story, And I gave him the name, and the Rav answered. He said, yes, 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 he said, I knew him. I knew him. He was a fine Talmud Chacham. I wouldn't rely on his gerus. Now, but I had somebody I could call. We know who the rabbis who are not reliable for their gerus are. It's known. The problem here is, I don't want to speak about myself. I have a pretty good record for 58 years. I haven't been doing, you know, quickie geruses like this man was doing in World War II. The husband was going to go overseas into the army, so he quickly converted the woman, and they got married, and that's it. And the Rav felt that's not the kind of gerus. But I know what the Rav standards for gerus were. They were certainly not to go and ask somebody about Brachas Achronos or Borer. And the Rav was not living even at a time. We live at a time when there are many people who want to become Jewish. Forget the Russians. That's a crisis in Israel that's got to be solved. Otherwise, it'll be much more umglick to face later on. But when I started out in America, somebody was intermarrying, they intermarried. The non-Jewish spouse didn't come to be converted. Today, we have 10 or 15 conversions that we do a year, and we don't have an institute for conversions. Each one is an individual case with whom we work for at least a year to get to understand, to know, to be able to live a religious life, and to start living a religious life. There's no problem with my conversion unless you're a gatekeeper. If you're a gatekeeper, then you want to keep anybody out who's not going to, you know, cover her hair or daven with a minion three times a day. You can't set up that kind of requirement for people. So nobody has faith in anybody. We used to be able to call up the executive director of the Rabbinical Council of America, and I rely on so-and-so's conversions. And he knew who yes and who no. No more. Now it's got to be through an anonymous based in. That's a bad system. And it's a bad system because 25 years from now, we're going to be facing a situation where people can't get married. The same situation as exists in Israel is going to exist in America. So we have to solve it. And the way to solve it is to do what we were doing before. You know who the reliable people are, and you know who the charlatans are. And you rely on the reliable people, and you want to have a system of GPS? Fine. Not everybody's going to fit into that GPS system, because basically it's a theoretical Rabbi Eliezer system. It's not a Chachamim system. There's got to be, you know, Chachamim system with standards. Okay, sorry to give you such a long answer, but that's what I'm going to be working on this year, Im Yirtzeh Hashem.
I want to thank Rabbi Lipstein. Really, you know, his